Good morning, everybody, and welcome. Welcome to this strange ritual we do. And a time out of the usual hurly-burly, just to sit and be still and be quiet and reflect. And this morning, I thought I'd give a talk on Karma 101. Karma is you hear the word all the time, and there are a lot of different understandings of it. One of the reasons I think that it's confusing is that it comes out of Indian culture initially in many different forms, because depending on the particular religious tradition that espoused it, it was defined differently. So it's really useful to think about what we mean when we talk about karma in this tradition. Good, bad, good karma, bad karma, good and evil. These are words we hear all the time in the social and political sphere, in the moral sphere. And as with everything in our practice, we can really contemplate for ourselves what, not take on somebody else's judgment, but what is it that I mean when I say something is good, something is bad, something is, what is good karma? What is it that I'm trying to develop? What am I doing? What is my basic intention in this practice? What is my basic intention in my life? So these are all this is kind of the territory that we think of karma as being part of. So it's really useful to go to the basic teachings according to the Buddha on karma. Karma is intentional action. There's not a book of the fates. What has happened in the past is done. Karma and our working with karma happens only each moment. So orienting ourselves to the moment is important, is an important aspect of this teaching. Buddha said, if everything were predetermined by the past, there would be no point in teaching a path to awakening. So all of us are somewhere in the middle of our lives. We all have done endless numbers of actions. And when we talk about action in this tradition, we talk about actions of body, of speech, and of mind. What we think, what we say, and what we do are all have consequences. So when we intend to awaken, to be an alert, awake, responsible, mature, relational human being, we need to develop an ongoing moment-by-moment awareness of our intentions. We choose our actions moment-by-moment. Or we don't. Or we go according to habit. We're on automatic, which is probably true for most of us much of the time. We have our routines. So awakening is contingent on having the intention to wake up. And this is a really underlying intention to contemplate and to take on with great determination. If we're going to be awake and fully alive and use our potential, all of our awareness, develop open to all of the that which our awareness gives us access to if we're paying attention, we need to intend to do it. Because what we're doing is going against the tide of habit, of shutting down, of being distracted. There are infinite distractions. So holding attention front and center is to understand what do we mean when we say this. we can look at our intention, and to do that, we need to look at what are the seeds that we're planting with each thing that we do. What seeds do we plant? What seeds do we water? We need to consider the causes of contentment and the causes of dissatisfaction. What allows my mind and my heart to be at ease? And what distresses me, disturbs my sleep at night, makes me anxious during the day? What allows me to be kind to others and to myself, and what gets in the way? So we're looking at our actions, our intention. And what is wise action? Wise action is kind of appropriate action. It's often said that, enlightenment is worthless unless it functions in our life. Unless we use what our awareness fully in our lives and accurately, then what's this all about anyway, right? So we can't be neglectful and careless. We can't be neglectful and careless and expect to be free from a troubled mind. The Buddha admonishes us to cultivate discernment, to look at the seeds we are planting, what we are watering. We are also admonished to relinquish desire, to renounce desire as our basic motivation for action. This is not a judgment against anger. This doesn't say, desire, because desire is the root of life in many ways, right? Attraction. Attraction brings together the egg and the sperm. It's a primary biological fact. But desire is way more amplified in us humans. And to be aware of not necessarily always going with desire, but being able to pause and recognize, is this a wholesome, fulfilling act, or is it going to undermine? And there are all kinds of examples of this. So our mind, our consciousness is neither inherently good nor bad, but our actions have implications for harm or for benefit. The Buddha defines discernment as insight into how the mind fabricates its experiences. So when we sit here, if we are going to look into how the mind is putting together the experience, it's really important to have the intention to not follow thinking, not follow thoughts, because otherwise we can't observe what we need to observe. That's the reason for it. It's not because thoughts are bad, but just because our intention when we're doing meditation is to develop, is to plant the seed of awareness, of discernment, of being able to look directly at what's unfolding. And so we can discern as best we can what is skillful and what leads to benefit, and what is unskillful and leads to harm. Some things are skillful, lead to benefit immediately. That bowl of ice cream, certainly lovely, lightens the spirits, delights the palate. But in the long run, can bring harm. It can, put on pounds that we don't need, or whatever. The first example that comes to my mind is always ice cream. But there are infinite other examples we could use. Huh?
We know where your desire is.
I had some killer chocolate pie.
So skillful brings an end to harm, to suffering, and unskillful leads to stress and difficulties. And we have the freedom to choose skillful actions or unskillful actions. And this forms the basis of our understanding about karma. This is in Mahayana Buddhism. What is skillful, what is not skillful? Good karma, bad karma. And so looking at how we understand these in relation to our practice, the words good and evil in English have very broad meanings. You know, it can be a good meal, which is delicious. It can be a good piece of wood, which is just the right shape that you need, right? Just the right quality or hardness. Looked at from one perspective, a good trade agreement brings benefit. From another perspective, it can actually promote harm. As we've all been studying this trade agreement theme for a while now. Good and evil also have very strong emotional valences to them. And as I was writing this, I thought of the axis of evil. And there are a lot of turning points in the public temper about things. And I just remember the first time that I heard Bush name three countries as the axis of evil, it turned on the bitter, fearful, it just amped up the energy that we had, the reactive energy that we started to have about these countries, in addition to whatever else had been going on with our relations with them. So it's really important, if we're thinking about karma, to think about the strength and the energy of the words that we use. I mean, when you can turn a whole world into a more dangerous place by using one word, applying one word to a power, those words are potent. So it's very important to be aware of the power of our speech, as well as our actions and our thoughts. So in our language, the words good and evil point to a judgment from an economic, a political, an aesthetic, a mechanical viewpoint, according to whatever values are held. The meaning in English, therefore, is quite broad of good and evil. Their meanings and their energies, their meanings carry energies that have consequences. I want to look at this term, these words now, in relation to karma, good karma and bad karma. And looking more closely at them can help us very specifically revise habits, be aware of habits we're forming and habits we want to change, habits of mind, of word, and of deed. And in doing so, not only do we ease suffering, but we can bring a more accurate understanding to the conditions we meet and can be guided in our responses. So one thing that the Buddha points out is that we don't burn off bad karma. Karma doesn't work like that. The Buddha uses an image of a lump of salt, a big lump of salt, put into a glass of water, makes a very disagreeable brew. A lump of salt the same size put into a sea is indiscernible. And that's true with how we approach our karma. We may not be able to do anything. There are only certain instances where we can do anything about what we've already done. But we certainly, from this moment forward, can change our whole approach to our actions. And so We're responsible for what we contribute to the karmic sea. And we are all awash in a universal karmic sea. And the words of one person affects all of us. In the language of the Buddha, which in the written language, which is Pali, also Sanskrit, sometimes the two coincided, good is expressed by the word kusala, and not good, ungood, I wouldn't say evil, is expressed by the word akusala, skillful or unskillful, and they have very precise meanings. They're not used as a set of social values. They are not social values, but in relation to what we do, think, or say, and the consequences that flow from what we do, think, or say. So what happens as a result of any action is determined by many factors. It's not simply, you know, I said this and this happens, right? There's a lot going on at all times. The universe is a vast web of interconnected factors, outer and inner. So we not only have our own preferences and influences, but we also are held in an embrace of the preferences and conventions of our culture. We have our own inner emotional landscape and our underlying intentions, and then how they come in relation to the broader, more collectively held. So the bases of kusala and akusala are the states of mind, the contents of mind, and the intention behind action. So our states of mind are various: excited, calm, depressed, expansive, distracted, all of the energies that kind of are underlying everything else. The contents of our mind are anything that we become aware of: mood, sense objects, and our reactions to them, thoughts, fantasies, memories, plans, intentions. All of this are the contents of our mind. And then the intention, our intention. Is it free of greed, aversion, and delusion? Is our intention marked by greed? Is it marked by aversion? Is it marked by confusion? It's really useful. Those are the three poisons, right? Because they obscure our ability to see what's actually needed and what's real. So how many times have I done something and realized, whoa, you know, I'm coming from a place of aversion there, which is often not useful. Or, whoa, look at that greedy energy. Based in a sense of separation, I need something that I don't have. And so that's a certain kind of energetic that's going to produce a certain result. Kusala is marked by awareness of this. So there are several qualities that are true of kusala, of skillful, supported by wholesome mental states, a stable mind, an untroubled mind, healthy. Another quality is, another thing that's kusala is anything that renders the mind clean and clear, not stained and murky. So what's something that would make our minds and our hearts murky?
Judgment.
Horror movies.
Yeah.
One more thing.
Scrolling through my Facebook feed on my phone.
Yep. Any of the distractions or substances, you know, alcohol can do that. Any of our addictions, Anything, any compulsive activity can murky up the waters. Kusala is also intelligent, based on knowledge, and the thinking mind, the thinking function is well employed, the discerning function. We always know when we have been motivated by a kusala sense, because it produces a sense of well-being, even if outer circumstances are not great. And what comes to my mind with that is, it may be a situation where we admit that we've lied about something. We go away feeling like, okay, that was the right thing to do, even if it's made a big mess in many ways. But at least we've begun to plant the seed for healthy, clear interaction. And then, and it promotes the quality and efficiency of the mind. I thought that that was an interesting part of the Buddha's list of what kusala qualities do. The quality and efficiency of the mind, when we are untroubled, when we are in accord with the way things actually are, we have much less to interfere and distract and make our actions indistinct. It's like in acting, when you have a role in acting, you want to be really clear what the intention is of this character in this line. Otherwise, the line doesn't, you don't know what they're saying, right? That's true in our lives too. Akusala is based in ignorance, which is not seeing the way things are. Akusala is harmful, unhealthy, results in confusion, ill health, and suffering, and causes the mind to degenerate in both quality and efficiency. It's much harder to think when we are caught up in a really unwholesome state of mind or version of a situation. So looking closely at kusala qualities allows us to appreciate and be much more sensitive to akusala qualities when they arise in our minds, which is really why we're talking about this anyway, is as we go forward in the day. I mean, when I was working on this, I realized to my dismay how much of my mind stream is unwholesome. Getting down to this very minute way of looking at it, that's useful. That's really useful. So when we talk about the kusala qualities, it's important to think about these in our own inner world and how we either cultivate them or don't cultivate them. So these are the ones that are listed by the Buddha. Firm, stable, resolute, undistracted. Pure and clean, meaning bright. So that's an energy, isn't it? A bright energy. Open. Clear and free, meaning unrestricted and boundless. Again, open. When we're open, when we go into a conversation with somebody about politics, how open or how full are you? I tend to be pretty full. And the challenge is, in a situation like that, what's my intention? Is my intention to connect and to listen and to relate? Or is it to prevail in some way? Is there a power, grasping, greedy kind of an energy behind it? Another one is fit for work. So kusala qualities allow us to be fit for work, which means pliant, fluent, and patient. The Buddha was a very detail-oriented guy. And I thought, fit for work, that's so interesting. Compliant, fluent, and patient. Yeah, that's true. And then calm and content, meaning relaxed, serene, and satisfied. So the practices that help us develop kusala qualities and strengthen them are mindfulness, sati. Mindfulness is often thought of as just paying attention. Well, that's part of it. But much more primarily, it is maintaining connection with your intention. Your intention to be quite open, present, intelligent about what's going on. So mindfulness is one thing that strengthens kusala qualities, and loving kindness is the other, which is goodwill and an understanding heart towards ourselves and others. Especially the things in ourselves that are hard to be kind about, and the things in others that are really pushing away qualities. That's when metta, loving kindness, is most needed, is when it's hardest to evoke. So therefore, you can see how intention really plays into that. If you intend to say, okay, I am going to really take this on. I'm going to work with those people, for instance, that really I just don't want to be near, and see if I can send loving kindness. I can evoke, I can remember this intention even. And then the conditions that are considered akusala are, you ready? Sloth and torpor, ill will, sexual desire, restlessness and anxiety, anger, jealousy, and greed. Does that sound familiar? What are those in Buddhist teaching?
The hindrances.
Those are the hindrances. The hindrances to being present, to being awake, to being responsive. Sexual desire, a lovely thing, a lovely aspect of our lives, right? But it also can confuse and obsess us. So that's where it becomes problematic. Jealousy, absolutely a human experience, can make us spiteful and oppressive. And greed can make us greedy. So the hindrances are something that we all get aware of as a hindrance. The beauty of all of these teachings is that we can look at them with a little bit of objectivity and not get down on ourselves, but say, oh yeah, this is a universal experience, and it distorts my ability to be loving and kind and present and responsible. And I can work with it. I have choices about how to respond when these promptings come forward in me. So if you're sensitive to kusala and akusala energies, you're in a better frame to choose to act according to kusala intentions. And so this is another way of saying you can be aware of creating good or bad karma. These energies can be coarse and obvious, or they can be much more subtle. So even after being a practitioner for years, there's always more to become aware of. I was just reading a piece by Hakuin Zenji, who was a great master, who said that long after you awaken, the most important work happens, because the subtlety with which these energies inhabit us and flow through us is unending. It's very important to just keep knowing that this is a way of life, this kind of looking into what is formulating within us, what is influencing our behavior. always something to be very tuned into. And it even occurred to me that it would be, as long as we have a body, we have these tendencies, and that even on our deathbeds, how we relate to our to promptings will have consequences. And I think about how incredibly helpful it was to me to be with my mother when she died, and the way that she died was so useful and helpful to me. It was such a blessing. And I know from others who've been with a parent who's died in extremis how it was very much not a blessing. It created a lot of anxiety and a lot of hurt. So if we think about our practice, part of our practice is taking responsibility for ourselves, how wonderful it is to practice really wholeheartedly so that even in the last moment we can give a blessing as we pass out. That everything in our life can be a blessing. So another thing that I'd like to say is, I hope I'm not going on too long here, but this is such a huge field of inquiry, that these qualities, kusala and akusala, are fluid and they can change in just an instant. That our intention can be one thing and it can lead to, our intention can be kusala and it can lead to akusala outcomes. Seemingly. So we just do our best, right? An example of that would be when you have an experience in meditation that's really an opening and you feel so encouraged, it can totally, it's a wonderful thing, right? But it can totally mess you up afterwards because you just cling to it and you just want to get it back. Or you think, I am such a good meditator. And so it strengthens the sense of self rather than relieving us of this separation feeling. Or, you know, something that's coming up a lot now is in the social political sphere, this sense of, if you're a liberal or a progressive type, your concerns are for everyone, the well-being of everyone, and you have a sense of interconnection and all of this, which is kusala, right? It's true. But it can lead to disdain for anyone who is not liberal or progressive, which is a real disservice and creates great harm and undermines the well-being, the broader well-being, as well as being a delusion that we are complex and enlightened and they are simple and not ignorant, filled with hate. Not true. So anyway, often people say, well, I acted with the best intentions and look at what happened, it's a mess. Yeah. That happens. Because we are interconnected, there's a lot going on. And we have sowed other seeds in the past as well that ripen at various times. The other way it can go too, which is sometimes something that's very harmful can actually lead to something pretty good. Which is something like fear of death can encourage introspection, can bring, and it brings a lot of people to meditation practice. So this karma making wheel is very subtle and it's ongoing. There's a phrase that Hakuin uses, which is Scrupulous devotion to hidden practice, which I think is a wonderful, wonderful phrase. Scrupulous devotion to hidden practice. This is part of it. Anything that we are working with internally, any inspiration that rules our observing, holding ourselves to be responsible for becoming aware of the workings of our mind. He goes on to say, scrupulous devotion to hidden practice is immersing yourself totally in your practice at all times and in all of your daily activities. So becoming aware of the workings of karma, of the energies, of the intentions that we have, moment by moment, is powerful practice that has real consequences. So may we all take this on, make our own observations, and do our best to create causes for happiness and well-being for ourselves and for everybody. Thank you.
Please turn to page 5 of your chant book, located under the front.